I know I've said before in sermons about how Scripture reminds us of the importance of knowledge. In particular, Paul often in Ephesians and Colossians reminds us that being transformed, having the power or the ability to live a transformed life, whether that's freedom from sin, a change in our circumstances, usually interior circumstances, freedom from the things that might limit us or bind us, that this transformation comes about through correct understanding or correct knowledge. And so this is where we started today. It's in the middle of chapter 1. Paul is beginning his letter with thanksgiving to God's greatness and then thanksgiving for the people he's writing the letter to. And he begins to say this is what he prays for them. He prays that they might, the God of glory, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, may give you a spirit of wisdom and of revelation in the knowledge of him. And Paul uses this Greek word knowledge that means knowledge through encounter, so it's real knowledge. And then he intensifies that real knowledge by saying real, real knowledge, so that your true and real knowledge would be real. But then Paul goes on to, I think, mention something that's very important. When we talk about knowledge, even knowledge through experience, we might think about our heads. 2 weekends ago, we had a conference called From Mind to Heart, precisely because it's important that God's truth begin to transform us by becoming part of our very inner being. And so Paul prays that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened, may be illumined, that the light bulb would go on inside you. And Paul's not talking about the heart in the ancient world was not Hollywood's heart or Roman's heart. The heart was the center of the person, including the mind, including thinking, but more importantly, including purpose, intent, will. You could say today, I like to think of it as the core of your identity. That at the core of your identity, you might be illumined, the light might be turned on, and you might see and know what? Paul tells us 3 things that he is praying for these people. That they might know because in their very core, they're open to the truth of God. They might know the hope of his calling. And the word call or calling has become a specialized term after 2,000 years of history. This isn't a calling to some sort of religious vocation. This is a, hey you, come on over. That's what the word call means. If you give somebody a call, you're not priesting them, are you? Now you just picked up your phone. That you might know the hope of the reality that God has drawn you to himself. The reason you're here today, among other reasons, is because God is drawing you to himself. God has given a call out, a hey you, come on over. And more importantly, God has given a call to us as his church. And there's a hope inside that call that God does not call for no reason. If God is drawing me to himself, there's some purpose, some good thing he has in mind. And that I might, Paul prays, that in my core, my identity, I might be aware and enlightened to this. That since God has drawn me to himself, that there's a hope for my future, whatever that looks like, and there's a hope for our future. Secondly, Paul goes on to talk about the riches of the glory of God's inheritance in the saints. We typically think about our inheritance as being what we are going to receive as children of God, co-heirs with Christ, sharing the inheritance of Jesus. But here the writer is talking about the hope of God's calling and the riches of God's inheritance. And the idea seems to be that God is preparing by drawing us to himself some crowning jewel in his own crown, some statement or testimony that's going to add to the glory of God. And if you can think about that, if you can think, if there is a God and he's the creator of the universe, sustainer of all that is, etc., etc., well, his glory or his majesty or his bigness is pretty big. How do we ever add to that? And it's not going to be some sort of stale bagel that's given to God to add to his glory. And so Paul wants us to understand that if we're being called to God and being prepared to be a jewel in the very crown of God, then there's something very wow going on. There's a wow factor associated with it. There's a vast treasure and richness that's associated with us being called to God, because it's going to be a crowning, you know, cherry on top of the glory of God. But Paul is really just working up to this, in part because all of these things, hope and riches, stem out of this. But because of his prose here, because of the language Paul is using, he's gearing up and he's climaxing it in his prayer here. And he goes on to say, and that you might know. So first of all, to know the hope of the calling, the riches of God's glory in his inheritance, which is us, and the surpassing greatness of his power. Now, Paul is just, so first of all, we know Paul is getting to his theme here. He's warming up because he's starting to be redundant. Greatness surpasses, but this is a surpassing greatness. What is the surpassing greatness of his power towards us who believe? And these are in accordance with the working. And here Paul multiplies synonyms for strength or for power. So Paul has just told us that there's something bigger than big, greater than great about God's power, which is being manifest towards us who have received the gospel, the good news, and have come to God in faith in Jesus Christ. That this exceeding bigger than big, beyond big power towards us is working, and the word there is energy, has the energy and the strength of his might. And so there's these three words added to power. They're all synonyms of power because Paul wants us to be amazed and stupefied by what he's describing here. And because he knows that we are still dealing in the abstract, he says, this strength, this power, this energy working through the strength of his might, the power that exceeds every boundary, God has manifest or demonstrated in Jesus Christ when he raised him from the dead. Now, all week I've been enamored by this analogy. It may work, it may not work. It'll work for some of you, I think. But I just want to kind of get us into the neighborhood of what Paul's trying to do for us here. So most of you have cars, know about cars, driven cars. You're familiar with vehicles. So vehicles go from standing still up to some speed, highway speed or whatever. So people are into this, wondering, you know, what kind of power their car has. They ask, or they're aware of their 0 to 60 speed, that 60 miles an hour, or 0 to 100K. And so, you know, you might say, you know, my car, not bad, you know, it'll do 0 to 60 in 5 seconds or 5.2. Well, you've got me beat. My Corolla's book, you know, the book for my Corolla is 7.6 seconds. So you've got me 2.4 seconds on 0 to 60s. You're tracking with me? If you get to like 4 seconds, you got a pretty hot car. 3, you know, you're probably out at the drag strip and you've got some serious modification going on. Now, if you got somebody who's really into cars and they're doing muscle cars, so probably rear-wheel drive, not front-wheel drive cars, you see them driving around town occasionally. You hear them if you don't see them. And they say, yeah, well, you know, I can get rubber in all 4 gears. And what that means, you ever heard people squeal their tires when they start? Right? So, first, I start, I go into second, I scorch again because I got that much power. Third, I'm doing like 45 miles an hour now, and I can still lay rubber. At fifth, you know, I'm 60 or 70 miles an hour, and I punch it. I'm going to lay rubber. Now I got some power here. The next guy says, you know what? I drop the clutch at first. My front end comes off the ground a foot and a half, 2 feet, man. All right. Then Jesus comes in, right? Jesus pulls up. He's got a bit of a sleeper. Jesus is kind of understated kind of guy, right? You know that. And people say, hey, Jesus, what's your car do? What do you got under the hood, Jesus? Jesus, kind of runs his hand along the fender there. It's like, well, this baby, let me tell you. This baby can raise the dead. Okay. I mean, now we've just changed all comparison, haven't we? Like, there's power, and then there's raising the dead. Doesn't even compute, right? Every power that you know is limited by your own death, about the reality of decay and disease and dysfunction in our world. The greatest power that you can imagine ends at death. And the power of God working towards us, this exceeding greatness beyond big power, was demonstrated through Jesus being raised from the dead. Not that Jesus was resuscitated to die again as an old man. If you don't know, Jesus died when he was 30-something on a cross. He was violently killed, executed by state. He didn't come back to life and then die as an old man somewhere. He was raised into a completely, qualitatively different stage and state of life with a resurrected body. He did not become a nameless spirit, a vague spirit out there pervading the cosmos. He became a new humanity. And that's the power that you and I have been brought into. And that's the power that Dax is going to be baptized into. Now, I think this is important because, and I think Paul's onto something here, because when we get to this description in Luke's gospel, I don't know about you, but I have a problem with this. Blessed, the word blessed means that you are fulfilled, that you're living the good life. Perhaps you've heard that term. Maybe you've had people tell you, living the dream. How you doing? I'm living the dream, man. I'm always a little suspicious about why they're motivated to say that. But at any rate, they are living the dream. Well, this is what Jesus says. You know you're living the dream when you are poor. You know you're living the dream when you hunger. You're living the dream, man, when men and women hate you, ostracize you, cast insults at you, spurn your name as evil for my sake. I think that's probably hard for us to imagine that, to do it, to be it. And there's, I think, three responses. There's probably others. There's three responses we can make. The first, which I think is probably the more common response, is to go, oh, that's nice, Jesus, and turn the page and hope he gets on to something else. You know, like, there's got to be something good coming up. We just realize this is unrealistic and impossible. The normal and healthy thing to do is just say, oh, well, you know, that's great. God saved me from that kind of blessing. And away we go. The second is for somebody to sort of just exert their willpower and their dominance and just kind of, I'm going to prove myself to Jesus. I can be this kind of person. If Jesus tells me this is what he wants me to do, then I'm going to love my enemies. I'm going to bless those who curse me. I'm going to do good to those who've harmed me. And they just kind of, by sheer willpower, make that happen. That's never struck me as kind of what Jesus was getting at, I think. There's always something that's a little off on those types of people if you've ever met them. Jesus is not assigning us a regiment for self-discipline and self-torture here. As important as self-discipline is, and maybe self-discipline is a stage on the journey, I think Jesus has something else in mind. And so this is where we need Paul's prayer. We need both the knowledge and revelation and wisdom and the insight that permeates our heart, but we need to be confident in the power that's available to us, resurrection power, power to raise the dead. Now, if you've ever felt yourself responding defensively or defending yourself or being angry about something, I can tell you you're angry and defensive because somebody has touched you in a place where you're insecure, you're not that confident. So our early service, some of you know Dr. Hack, Hank Hack. He's, I don't know, 6'5", 6'7". And I said, probably Hank, if you walked up to him and said, "Hey, shorty," he's not going to be offended. He's not going to be particularly troubled by that. He might even laugh. He might go, "Man, you got a sense of humor," as he looks down, you know, a foot, foot and a half towards your head. That's funny. I'll have to remember that. "Hey, shorty." That's a good one. Now, why can he laugh? Well, because at this time and space in our culture, he's not a short man. He's probably never been short. He was probably a long baby, you know? And he's just not insecure about being short. But when you and I hear, "Blessed are the poor," or "Blessed are those you when you're reviled," and we have an uneasy reaction to it, we know that we aren't secure there. That there's something about being poor that troubles us and threatens us. That there's something about losing the esteem and respect of other people that threatens us. And Paul is telling us, if you knew you were driving a car that could raise the dead, then you wouldn't worry about these little Jap scrap modifies that pull up beside you and sound like some sort of humming bee. You know what I mean? Meh, meh, meh. And you're like, "Buddy, this baby can raise the dead. You go on, knock yourself out." Can you imagine a world in which in your core identity, you were confident that you were tied into the greatest power of the universe? Not a power to be some sort of blustering big man or big, you know, dominant woman or person, but a power to be free, a power to be loving. Imagine this, that at the core of your identity you knew that you were tapped into a power that was bigger than your greatest anxieties and your biggest insecurities. Imagine what that might look like. To let go of defending yourself and just loving instead. To let go of posturing, trying so hard to keep up the appearances, and just investing in loving your neighbors or your enemies instead. And this is the picture of for humanity that Paul has given us. This is the only way I think that Jesus could realistically expect or ask that people might live this way. This picture that Jesus gives us in the gospel. It's because he knows that once he's been able to illumine and enlighten our very inner being with an understanding and a revelation of our hope in him, the riches that he's already shared with us, and the exceeding abundant beyond big of his power, then we can begin to live free. We can begin to approach life like this with palms held wide open. And I can guarantee you this. If you started living that way, free from your deepest insecurities, your children would notice. Your spouse would notice. The people you work with would notice. You would notice. So we need two things. First of all, we need an awareness. That's where knowledge comes in. We need to allow the awareness to activate our imagination, to touch our inner part where we might dream and long for some sort of such a freedom, such a life. And then probably like Paul, we need to just start praying for it, for ourselves and for each other, for our family, for our parish. So this is what it means to be part of this new humanity, this fellowship of saints, when we celebrate All Saints, when we baptize a baby and bring them into the family, we're saying, we're opening up to you all these potential and possibilities to have the power of God, resurrection power, begin to transform and permeate your life. But there's a journey, we all know that. And part of the journey is dreaming big and praying even bigger. And part of the journey is just resting in the love of God. Well, may it be so among us. Amen.